Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, the show dedicated to discovering jewels of wisdom for increasing ROI for REIs, that is, return on investment for real estate investors. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is our 102nd episode. Today, I'm talking with Don Costa on rehabbing and selling over 100 houses per year. When I heard that number, the three questions that came to mind were, one, how does he find those 100 fix and flip deals each year? Two, how does he fund those 100 fix and flip deals? And three, how does he complete the construction on those 100 fix and flip deals? Of course, he is about to share the answers right now, so here we go. All right, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Don, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. You?
No complaints. We finally got weather in the 80s here, which we've politely waited and patiently waited for here in Chicago. You're hailing from Fresno, California. What's your weather like out there, Don?
Right now it's pretty comfortable. We're sitting in the mid to high 70s. We're starting to get a little cooler right at the moment, so I can't complain. We get up to like 110 degrees of dry heat in the summer, and I'm not looking forward to it, so we're good right now.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we don't see much of that in Chicago here. It's a little bit of the moist heat, but not that bad. Don, for listeners who don't know, you know, I've checked you out, know your podcast and everything like that, but could you give us a background of how you got started in real estate and what your business looks like today, the Reader's Digest version?
Absolutely. So I got started in real estate in 2003. Like a lot of people, I think I had circled it for a few years before that. I bought courses by Carlton Sheets and the different kind of infomercial courses that aren't really around anymore, but were big deals back then. And I had gotten married, had recently gotten married, and I was wanting to get into real estate investing. I hadn't had kids yet, and I figured that was my chance. I was unemployed. And so I went in an interview with a mortgage company. And the gentleman interviewing me asked me, you know, why do you want to be in the mortgage business? And my answer to him, which was probably, it was the dumbest thing to say in an interview, but it was the smartest thing I said at the time because it opened a lot of doors. But I told him, no, you know, I'm not really interested in being a mortgage guy. I want to learn the finance side of the business because I want to be a real estate investor. And he kind of paused for a minute, and I realized what I said, and I thought the interview was over, and he leaned across his desk and said, you know, go out and find some properties. I'll put the money up. And I went out, started knocking on doors, pre-foreclosures, notice of defaults, started knocking on doors, talking to homeowners, had a knack for getting, you know, identifying a deal and getting it in a contract. And the rest is kind of history. I ended up making a really, really good living, a lot of money doing real estate investing. And you know, built a really nice business, got my head bigger than it probably should have been, thought everything I touched turned to gold, started other businesses. And then we all know what happened in 2008. The market crashed. And because I wasn't running a real business at the time, I basically went down with the ship and kind of wallowed in self-pity for a handful of years until I realized that, you know, I had no other option but to get back in the game. And I jumped back in 2012 and I built a real business that time around with, you know, a real team and the fundamentals, right, of real estate investing in business and core values. And we stay focused on our core competency, which is, you know, basically rehabbing. And I have a business that does over 100 properties a year, you know, rehabs. And our goal for 2018 is to do 200. So.
All right. Yeah, I can relate to the bumpy ride. And I know a lot of my listeners heard the story where, you know, it was the same kind of thing. I got in 06, so I was a little bit late to the party. And I could feel the exuberant excitement as I did walk into those networking events and, you know, the places where in Philadelphia, you know, the other real estate investors were hanging out. And I'd look at the comps, Don, and I remember, I mean, I was like 26 years old at the time. Didn't have much, no experience in real estate before that. But I remember thinking like, man, these prices just, they feel outrageous. Like these things went up, you know, doubled in the last 5 years or whatever it was back then. There's no way this is sustainable. And it wasn't. And, you know, I had a very similar story to yours where I feel like this time around, you know, building the real business with the systems, with the marketing machines in place, with the ability to underwrite deals this time, like I hope and pray that I wouldn't find myself again in the 2009, 10, 11, you know, slump that literally wiped out so many real estate professionals, investors, mortgage brokers, along with the rest of the economy as it crippled. But I guess, you know, we'll find out hopefully our experience and our work and systems and the real business we built will sustain us if, in fact, the downturn is to come at some point. Don, you talk about the team that you used to flip 100 or so houses last year and hopefully double that this year. Can you talk about the structure of that team and what maybe in the last 12 to 18 months that team and each person has done to build out 100 units in a year?
Yeah, you know, so our team looks a little different this year than it did last year. But, you know, last year, for the most part, I had two acquisitions guys, two project managers. I have an office person who's like a bookkeeper transaction coordinator. And then we have like a sister real estate company that handles a lot of our real estate transactions. And that was the core team for primarily the last couple of years. And this year, the front end of our team is a little bit different. We actually hired three lead managers to answer incoming calls, basically 24/7, the way we got them scheduled. We hired some new acquisitions people. We moved one of our acquisitions guys to disposition, so we were doing more wholesaling this year. And, you know, I split my office person that was doing books and transaction coordinating to now I have a transaction coordinator and then Cass, who's like the heart and soul of my organization, does all my investor relations and bookkeeping and stuff like that. So now we're a 10-person team. I want to say before the switch, we were about a 6-person team, you know, and we ran really, really lean for the volume we were doing, which is, you know, the testament to the people that I have on my team. They're really, really, really just phenomenal people. I'm really lucky to have them and, you know, totally blessed to have them. So, but yeah, I mean, that's what it looks like.
Nice. Yeah, I appreciate that. It's cool to see the growth. You sort of answered the second question was how did it change this year and what additions and changes you made? But you just answered that. So on to the next one, Don. What markets are you investing in and what price points are your average deal? If you could just take an avatar deal and then break that down for us.
Yeah. So our primary home-based business is Fresno, California, and we do kind of a 45-minute radius around Fresno, which is the majority of the business we do. We go about 2.5 hours north to Modesto, California. We go about an hour south to Visalia, Tulare, California. And then we do some other markets. I dabble now this year. I do some stuff in the Bay Area of California. We do some stuff up in Eugene, Oregon, Springfield, Oregon area. And so, but the core of our business is in Fresno. And this year in 2018, we're starting to branch out more. We're hitting North San Diego, Oceanside, California, and we're starting to branch out a little bit more just because we've gotten some really good systems in place to be able to handle new markets. And again, we're rehabbers. So our primary business is rehab. That's a core. So I'm really particular about being able to control the markets we're in to make sure we have the right team in place, the boots on the ground to do that kind of stuff. So I'll branch into new markets, but I won't necessarily do it as quickly as somebody who's primarily a wholesaler, if that makes sense.
It does. There's more risk, et cetera. What price point would your average deal be, Don?
So we're first-time, second-time buyer, home buyer price points, no matter what market we're in. In our market, that puts us on average between $100,000 and $200,000 all in with purchase and rehab. So in our typical, you know, ARV resale is going to be somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000, kind of in that range. So that's our first-time second-time buyer price point. Now, we do some stuff in markets like the Bay Area, and, you know, your first-time, second-time home buyer price point is going to be $500,000. So it's going to be a little different, you know, in some areas of California, but our primary market is going to be in the $150,000 range, roughly, for our all-in purchase and rehab.
Am I correct in assuming that the further your circle gets, the reasoning behind that is to go from 100 to 200 deals?
Not necessarily. So the reason why we're doing more wholesaling this year and more wholetailing, and for those in the audience who don't know what wholetailing is, it's buying it and throwing it on the market without touching it, right? You own it, but so it's very similar to wholesaling. We're doing more wholesale to be able to do the 200 transactions this year. We're branching out into other markets just because we've through having a podcast and different things that I've been doing, I've developed really good relationships with people that I feel very comfortable working with. And since we have set up we essentially have a boiler room call center. I hate to say the word boiler room, but we have this room where we have, people answering phones, our acquisitions people working out of. So we can handle the incoming calls really, really well when we're doing our direct mail marketing. One of the reasons why I made the switch is because at 2017, our direct mail cost, was creeping up significantly. And I just felt like there was a better way to manage the process of handling incoming calls from all of our marketing channels. And so we built this team out internally, and they can handle, they can basically handle a lot. So we're starting to turn on other markets because it's why not just, put some more, opportunities for revenue through the operation. And it's kind of like the perfect storm of opportunity, being prepared and opportunity meeting at the same time. So.
Gotcha. So when you go to these other markets that are a little bit further away, are you doing these renovations for the first, second time home buyer, 100K all in, a little bit of repair work there? Are you using contractors that you've never used before? Do you have a process for vetting them out? Or is that going to be, as you're going into these new further markets, there's not even an option to do the renovations?
So as we go into the further markets, we will definitely be cherry picking the renovations. We are rehabbers by trade, and we don't, so when we ever have an opportunity to rehab and have it be a very good payoff, we're going to do it. We will probably do more wholesale in those markets just because they are outlining markets and they're a little further from our home base. But we've done some crazy stuff. Like we work with general contractors. We don't work with anything but general contractors in our projects. So I'm very particular about that. We have shipped a team up into another city and had them stay, on site basically through the renovation because it was cheaper to do that and pay them per diem for their, room and board than it was to hire somebody local in one of the markets that we've been dabbling in. But we do general contractors. Typically, we'll hire somebody local if the market makes sense. And I have this weird way of hiring people in my organization. I believe in hiring the person and not necessarily the skill set. I believe I can always develop the skill set, but you can't teach somebody how to be hardworking and loyal, right? So even with the general contractors we work with, I go through this process. So, and I'll just real quick kind of snippet of what it looks like. I want to see a project that they're working on for two reasons. One, if they're not working, then I feel like that's a red flag. Then if they are working and they have a project going, I want to go and see it because I want to see, are there health and safety issues? Is it cluttered? Is it organized? For what they're telling me, they, as far as where they're at in the job, does it look like that matches to what the job site says? Are they supposed to be finished in 3 days and it looks like there's a week worth of work and there's nobody on site or one guy on site? I'm looking for the red flags that they may not realize I'm looking for, because I want to see how they manage their business and they manage the process. The second thing I do is I want to see a finished job. I don't want to talk to customers. I don't want referrals or what's the word, references, because they're going to find the person who's going to say the nicest thing about them, right? So I want to see the job. Yeah, I want to see the job, and it's not because I want to see how good their work is. I want to find something that I can pick out that's a flaw. So one of the best guys that I have that I've worked with for almost 6 years now, when we're on the job site, there was some issues with the way the baseboard kind of butted up against each other and you could see the seam and it wasn't straight. And I picked on that and I said, basically that's not going to fly with me. What happened here? Why is the quality not good? And I'm looking for his answer. Is he blaming, that guy sucked and I fired him. That homeowner was on my back and I just had to get out of here quickly. They say anything like that, I'm not getting them the job. They're blamers, right? They're not taking responsibility. This guy was like, you know what? You're right. It should have been done better. If that happens on one of your jobs, we'll rip it out and do it again. And I was like, no brainer. I'm going to hire this guy. So I'm looking for the person. I'm looking for the character. And that has served us very, very well when we're hiring.
Nice. What is your highest value skill set now, Don, in your business? What would you say this is the thing that no one else can do and you personally or the business itself is getting the most value out of your activity doing this? What is it?
Staying out of the way.
Yeah. Fair enough.
If I'm being honest with you, one of the biggest things that somebody does in their organization that costs them money is they become a bottleneck. When you hire a good team and you put your, you know, you develop them properly and you're able to put, you know, them to the task and count on them to get it done, stay out of the way. Let them do their job. And that's the thing that was the hardest thing for me to learn, because I was a control freak. I think like any other entrepreneur, nobody else can do it better than me, right? That's how we are, right? Because we've gotten our butt kicked and had the garbage, you know, shoved down our throat and everything else. We've been through it. So we're like, no one else can do it the way we do it. But really, a lot of my team does it better than I could have ever done it. And if I don't get out of the way and just let them do their job, I'm costing myself money.
So let's take it from another perspective. Somebody who's in the first 1 to 3 years of their business, you know, it's for you and me, it's 2003 to 6, 2006 to 8, something like that. Along the way, we discovered or developed high-value skill sets, Don. What would you say would have been some of the top three highest value skill sets that you developed as a real estate investor, fix and flip, that then, you know, you were able to teach to somebody else, implement a system, hire a team, build that around? What would be those three high value skills if you could identify them?
You know, off the top of my head, I would say one, I became very good at identifying who was the caliber of person that I needed in an organization or to work with, you know, that fit the culture of the organization, whether they're external, you know, contractors or vendors, or they were internal employees. And that was one of the things I taught, you know, to our project manager here, you know, for instance, you know, I had to teach him how to see that, how to identify, you know, who we were going to work with and who we weren't going to work with. Identifying a deal, what was a deal and what wasn't, I became very good at that. You know, it's something that I've had, you know, had to develop my team into, you know, not square pegging, round hole, and trying to make things work that weren't going to work. And then, you know, raising private money was a really good one for me. And it came down, I think in all aspects of all of that, the skill set, that the primary skill set that I developed that, and it's hard to teach, but I try to really instill it in my team, is know your value. When you walk into a situation, whether it's with a contractor or a private money lender or a seller, you walk in there confident, knowing your value, and you're on the same level as they are. You're not better than them. You're not less than them. You're on the same level. And, you know, being able to be confident and know the value that we're bringing to the table as an organization whenever we're doing anything, I think sets us apart. And it's phenomenal at, you know, helping me raise private money. It's phenomenal at helping me pick a good team to work with, outside vendors to work with. It's something that as I've instilled that into my acquisitions managers, they become very good at closing deals. You know, and two of my acquisitions managers this month are competing with each other on who can get, you know, the first 10 contracts, you know, this month, you know, type of thing. You know, they start this competition and who can get the 10 first and step, you know, so, and they're able to do that because they know what we bring to the table as a company, and they're confident in that, and they're able to sell that. So, yeah, I guess if that answers your question.
Nice. Yeah. Well said. Do you have, or, I should say, what is your day-to-day contribution now over the last 2 months, 3 months, Don?
So I know it's going to sound kind of repetitive when I say this, but staying out of the way. So my organization at this point in time, we are rehabbers. I could not tell you what the cross street is, you know, on any of the properties that we're doing. I don't see them anymore. I'm in the office more so because I'm tweaking and finding new ways to, you know, to better our marketing, to better, you know, to add to the bottom line, to make sure the team has what they need. And then I'm screwing around, honestly, doing, I have the podcast, and we're doing a whole bunch of YouTube production content stuff around the office. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, that's really what I do. You know, I'm in the place where most people want to be in their organization, where I'm not needed. And if I disappeared for 2 months, the organization would still run properly. So really, really ideally, my overall contribution is to give some fatherly advice, I guess, when I need to, and then stay out of the way.
Nice. What are your best deal sources over the last year or so? You did 100 deals. Are they all from direct mail? Is there a mix? Referrals? Can you dive into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to when I first started in 2012, I literally had lost everything before that. I could not rub two nickels together. I didn't have the money for marketing. I didn't have the money for direct mail. I didn't have the money to do any of that. I was too worried about keeping my lights on, right? And I started networking, OPM, other people's marketing, networking events. That still today, you know, is a huge source of deals for us, and it's neglected. I think everybody wants to push a button on the next shiny object and have great deal flow, and they ignore the free deal flow, right? Through, you know, I would call other people's bandit signs. I would call Craigslist posts. I would call, you know, real estate agents, you know, ads. And I would introduce myself and I invite them to lunch. And all those relationships I built have really carried us. It's been the foundation of my business through the years. And it's a huge source of opportunity for us for deals. I get calls all the time. This is falling out of escrow. If you offer X, it's yours. This is a hoarder house and they want to list it, but they don't want it to be on the MLS. They don't want people walking through it. If you can offer this, it's yours. You know, wholesalers call me up, you know, with deals. So networking is something that I do still, and I've taught my team to do, my acquisitions people to do, and it's a huge deal source for us. And I think the reason why I want to harp on a little bit is I feel like most people are either too scared to do it or too lazy to do it, or they just overlook it. And they really need to get out there and network a lot more. It's going to be the foundation of your business. You know, I can promise you that. So beyond that, our second best deal source, we shake every single bush. You know, we do all of it, right? But our second best deal source right now is direct mail. And I honestly believe the direct mail is strong for us at the moment just because of the customer experience. From the moment they call to the moment we close escrow, we've just got that dialed in. We got rapport right from the get-go, conversations, you know, follow-up, all of it in place right now, dialed in so tight that it's paying off well for us. And a lot of people, I don't know if you've heard it lately or not, but a lot of people say direct mail is dead. Yeah, because people are getting so many postcards or letters from so many people. If you have the right experience where you can capture that caller, if you can provide the right experience through the process to where they don't feel like they need to call anybody else, direct mail is still a great deal source.
Let's talk about that. So the direct mail has a phone number on it. They're calling that phone number. I'm putting two and two together, Don. And it's the lead management team of two or three people in the boiler room that takes these calls. How do you provide the right experience? You just recently did this in the last year or so. We just talked about this. So what are they saying to the sellers? If you could, even if you have the script off the top of your mind, like how does this interaction with the seller take place on that phone call so that you're providing a better experience than the next postcard that seller is going to call?
So the script that they don't go off a script, but the script that we use to train them, because you always need a script to fall back on in case the conversation gets stale, is something that John Martinez produced. John Martinez is one of the best sales trainers for real estate investing and acquisitions out there right now. And we just use his standard script. I'm sure you could probably find it just about anywhere online to train our team. But to be honest with you, the whole point is of the call when they answer is to engage in conversation. Our team is not just order takers. Now, we do have standard questions, you know, how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms, why are you selling, do you know the value of your home, do you know what you'd like to get for it? All those things are weaved into the conversation, but the overall conversation is just talking, getting to know the seller, building rapport, making them comfortable with who we are. You know, some of the calls can be 30 minutes, 45 minutes sometimes where they get into talking to the seller about their family and their life and everything else. It's not just, you know, let's ask scripted questions and get an appointment. That's first of all. Once we book the appointment, our acquisitions managers will call within 24 hours. The lead manager tells them, you know, your acquisitions manager is so-and-so. You'll hear from them in the next 24 hours. They're going to let you know basically what's going to happen on the appointment, if you have any additional questions, and so on and so forth. Our acquisitions managers call as soon as they can, introduce themselves, and again, the same thing, start building a rapport with the seller. We try to make it not just we're going to buy your house. It's more of we're going to solve your problems. So we're going to make it as easy as we can for you. And so they introduce themselves, they confirm the appointment time, let them, you know, answer any questions they have. The day of the appointment, they call again. Through this process, the seller is getting what to expect emails from us. You know, that goes out immediately after the lead manager takes up the phone. You know, basically an email goes out, this is what to expect on your appointment. Here's a reminder email, so on and so forth. Acquisitions manager calls on the day of the appointment to confirm the appointment. Again, works on building rapport. I mean, the whole thing all the way through. Once we got you in contract, we're still following up with you to make sure you don't have any questions. Yeah, make sure you understand what the process is like. If you need anything from us, legitimately, we're touching them constantly until we actually close that escrow.
Nice. Well thought through process there. Percentage wise, what percentage of your business, I know you may not have, maybe you do have an exact percentage, but of deals that came through networking and those other sources just based on your reputation in the market versus those for direct mail last year and maybe what you expected to be this year?
Over 50% of our deals last year came from network and networking. And I would say that was probably the case through, you know, through the last few years. This year, because of the way we're handling the calls that come in and our processes on the front end, our outbound marketing, direct mail being one of our strongest sources at the moment, our outbound marketing is probably going to be in the 60 to 70% range. That doesn't mean we're getting less deals from networking. It just means that we found a way to squeeze more deals out of our marketing channels by means of the way that we're handling the calls from the moment they come in.
Yeah. I mean, if you take direct mail, you can scale up, right, Don? It's like, I can push a button. I can spend the money. If I have the money, I could do 5,000, you know, mailing in one, I could do 25,000 the next. I could do 100,000 if I have the money the next, even 200,000 or, you know, crazier numbers, I guess, bigger than that. But is there a way that you were able to predict or were you comfortable with the uncertainty of whether or not deals were going to come through those networking channels? Or did you just comfortably grow that and continue to gain momentum and gain momentum and gain momentum over the last 6 years in the networking thing? How did you deal with that, Don?
I guess the prediction part of it obviously it's a little more difficult. You mean when you do your KPIs, your key performance indicators for marketing channels, like I can tell you on one list I mail to, I get a 0.5% response rate, nothing sexy, but every 30 phone calls equals a contract. You know, I can tell you on another channel, I get a 0.875% response rate, close to 1%, but it takes 45 phone calls to get a contract. And when you have that data, you can just throw more fuel on the fire. You can throttle it up. You can throttle it down. You know, I spend a little more money and add another acquisitions manager and I'm doing that many more deals. With networking, you don't necessarily have that clarity. I can say that there's a number of agents that I have great relationships with that are good for 3 or 4 deals a year. And they've been pretty darn consistent at that. So you can kind of, I guess, extrapolate what your volume is going to be for the year with that. But that's one of the reasons why I did what I did at the beginning of the year with our marketing and how we handled our marketing. You know, two reasons. One, the marketing costs were climbing. I felt like we were leaving money on the table. I felt like we weren't properly squeezing the fruit. And two, you know, as I pull myself out of my organization, it's really, really hard to hand my network over to my team because those are my friends and my relationships. So while my team is building their own relationships and stuff like that, and they're able to produce fruit from networking, I felt like as I move out of my day-to-day operations, some of that's probably going to die off. I hope not. So I kind of pulled away from it. But if you have the right relationships for those people who aren't, you know, pulling out and you're going to be in your business for a while, if you have the right relationships, you're the go-to person. You know, 3 or 4 deals a year, at least from an agent. So if you have 10 agents you're working with, that could be 30 to 40 deals a year. You know, wholesalers, you know, the wholesalers kind of have an ebb and flow, right? Depending on, you know, where they're at in their business. But, you know, they could be good for 1 or 2 deals a year or 1 or 2 deals a month, you know, depending on your relationship with them. So you can do the math the same way, you know, your KPI is kind of the same way and get an idea what your business is going to look like for the year.
That's pretty cool to hear that you've been so successful with the networking for deals piece. I always seem like I end in frustration where it just never seemed to be enough to keep our pipeline filled. So I really turned to the direct marketing and those channels. I've spent, 25 to 50% or more of my revenue on building those streams over the years, to the point of like nearly going broke doing that to learn how to squeeze more juice out of the fruit, like you said, and get the processes down and actually close the deals you're supposed to close out of those investments. So that's really cool, Don. I know that there's a question burning on listeners' mind right now, and that's how do you fund 100 deals a year? Can you touch on your private money relationships system, how you started doing that and how you got better, and maybe some of the things you do these days to keep that rolling in, if anything?
Yeah, let me say something first about networking before I answer that question. And I want to point this out because I think people will, the cardinal sin in networking is, hi, my name's so-and-so, can you send me deals? Networking is about relationships. It's about building real friendships, about taking the lunch, taking the coffee, adding value to their business. If you call somebody up and you say, I'm so-and-so, this is what I'm doing, I'd love to do business with you, how can I add value to your business? You start a conversation that turns into a real relationship. If you can do it that way, you're going to be successful. If it's, hi, my name's Bob, and I'm a new wholesaler, and please send me deals, and you hang up the phone and never call them again, it's not going to translate the same way. So I just want to share that, for the audience. Yeah.
You got a point. When I was broke and I was only a wholesaler for the reasoning of having no money to close on the deals, the only value that I could provide when I got in the business in 2006, I had to have my dad give me a ride to the networking events. So there was no hope of me doing deals otherwise, but there were a couple different kind of people. There were the people just like you described yourself being, Don, who did take me out to lunch and really opened the door for me and helped add value. And some of those people are still my business partners to this day. And they've done, one guy in particular has probably done 100 deals that no one else in the world ever knew about. And like the offensive question that I would get, which I'm going to share here before we get on to the other one, because I'm sure that people are on both sides, either as wholesalers hearing this offensive question or accidentally being a buyer, fix and flipper, rental investor and asking this question. And that's like approaching the wholesaler and saying something to the effect of, I want you to call me on your deal before you send it out to the list. Like, send me the deal before you send it to anybody else. And I'm like, you would try to do that as a wholesaler. I would try to appease that early on because I'm like this guy trying to make a name. And it just turned into a bunch of time wasting. So I suggest never asking that question directly, even if that's something that you want. And the best way to get that type of VIP treatment, the phone call before the email blast from a wholesaler, is just to buy property. If it makes sense at what the wholesaler is offering it to you at, pay the wholesaler's price. Don't negotiate them down. If it doesn't make sense, make the offer and, negotiate down if at all possible. But the guy who got the 100 deals or so for me, Don, he would either just pass on the deal or he would take it at whatever I was asking if he could make it work at that price. So where am I going to go? I'm going to go to the path of least resistance as a wholesaler. The guy paid my price. He's definitely getting a phone call. I'd way rather deal with the same person I know is going to close the known entity than to send it out to the email list and have to run the whole rigmarole with showings and everything else. So I just wanted to kind of leave that nugget too, since you were touching on that.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. So, okay. Private money question. Private money question. How we fund our deals and everything else. I don't use hard money at all. I use only private money. And this is the epiphany I had a while back. I only use private money who does 100% financing. And so I raise private money the same way everybody else does. I run my mouth. I tell people what I'm doing. I spoke at a RIA on Wednesday night. I'll probably end up getting, somebody out of that RIA that's interested in lending. I talk to agents I work with. I talk to other private money lenders I work with and ask for recommendations. There's no, as far as finding private money lenders, there's no secret sauce. You just got to run your mouth and ask and ask and ask and ask. So my secret for closing private money is very, very simple. I never ask for the money in the meeting. I don't go in with a project I'm trying to pitch. I don't go in with a credibility packet. I go in and I sit down and I have a conversation with the individual. And the whole goal of the conversation, I let them know right up front, is to see if our goals are aligned. and to see if we're, you know, we're somebody that we want to do business with each other. And I have a conversation about, you know, what terms they lend on, what rate they need to lend, what we typically pay, how we typically borrow, what our typical time frames are. And if everything seems good, then I always close it with, it looks like we can do something together. Let's do one and see how it goes. And, you know, if I have something come up in my pipeline that fits your criteria, I'll send it over. And that was my conversation, whether I needed the money right then and there or I didn't need the money at all. Because if you go in trying to pitch a project you have to close on, they're going to feel the desperation all over and they're not going to lend to you. If you go in and you basically go on equal footing and you're just having a conversation, you can email them an hour later and say, I've managed to find this in my pipeline. It looks like it meets your criteria. You're interested in doing the loan. And that's a much better way of pitching somebody than it is going in there and trying to sell a project. So that's how I talk to them. It's worked very, very well, created some great relationships out of it. Always, always halfway through the first transaction, halfway through the first loan, you know, project, they're asking me if I have more. You know, that's always the way it works. So I treat all my lenders with respect. I make sure that they are taken care of. We haven't had a project go south, but I let it be known that if anything doesn't work out, I'm going to make them whole. I'm the horse they bet on. I know I'm rambling a little bit about it, but I want to get it out. So a lot of people will go into and talk to a lender when the lender says, how's the property secured? And they'll go, oh, it's a deed of trust. You can foreclose if I, you know, don't finish. What I hear when somebody says that to me is, if it gets hard, I'm going to quit. So, right? So it's like, I tell them the property is secured by deed of trust. That's the collateral. I'm the security. I'm going to see the project through to the end no matter what. So relaying that helps a lot. It's made me very, very good at raising private money. So what's, you know, at the end result, you know, that's allowed us to raise enough to do what we do. But the other thing that helps us as a business, and I think it's part of what I do to mitigate risk in the market, is our time. Everything we do is on a time. Like our average turn time for flips is 100 days from the time we basically buy the property to the time we get our check. Most of them are in the 80 to 90 day range. The reason why we're 100 day average is because, you know, FHA, sometimes you can't put a property in contract till day 90, and so you're not going to close till day 120. But I'm in and out of those projects. That's the other thing that has allowed us to have the money available to what we do. For what we do is, if we're turning the project so quickly, that money is just turning into the next project, to the next project, to the next project. So, long-winded answer. Hopefully, I got it all out.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, definitely gave some nuggets of wisdom there in the conversations. And there's a lot of script stuff. And if somebody's thinking about raising private money, you're probably going to want to stay the episode and cycle back a few minutes and just listen to the things Don said, because it will help you have that conversation if you have not done so already, with the private lenders, by saying the right things and really understanding what's important to them. But it really sounds like what it boils down to, Don, is just like your deal source. You've been one hell of a networker over the years, and you basically applied that same principle to the private money. I mean, am I right in that? There's no real silver bullet other than the hard work there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a networking. It's a talking to people. It's a running your mouth. I always tell people to run your mouth. I mean, just an example, you know, I picked my son up from a play date and they were renovating their house. I hadn't handed the mom a card and said, if you need any help with contractors, give me a call. I flip houses. Months later, her brother calls me and says, this agent sold me 4 properties. He was supposed to help me flip them. I can't get a hold of him, and I need help. I went out to review the properties with them, realized that they're in over their head. Basically said, I'll help you get out of this mess. You obviously aren't flippers. Why don't you just lend me money? They turned out to be great lenders, right? And it all came from me basically telling somebody that I flip houses. So the secret is run your mouth. If you want a silver bullet out of the conversation as far as finding private money lenders, run your mouth constantly.
Nice. Cool, Don. I would like you to answer this next question two ways. First, what would be one or two book recommendations you make to somebody just getting started in the business? And second, what would be one or two book recommendations you'd make to somebody already successful in real estate?
How to Win Friends and Influence People is probably a really important book to read. It's kind of an older book, but it really, if you're going to be networking and building a team of people and building a proper business, you're going to want to make sure that you develop and hone your skill set for for being, you know, obviously somebody that's really likable and easy to work with. So How to Win Friends and Influence People was a book that I actually was a bad kid. I was a fighter in school. And I had a principal hand that to me, and that changed my life. So that's a big one.
How about that? That's an interesting way to have that book brought to your attention. That's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great book. And it's still, like I said, it's an older book. It was written like in the 30s or something like that, but it's tried and true to this day, the principles of it. So that's a huge one. Obviously, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad is one that a lot of people read that changed their lives. I think Think or Grow Rich is a good one as well. So I like the older books. But now for today, somebody that's got a business that's going really well, Traction and Rocket Fuel are two great books to read. I could go on and on about books, man. It's crazy. But Never Split the Difference is a great one to read. For negotiating, there's so many great books out there now. And with Audible, you know, being able to listen to them, you know, there's no excuse not to be just pouring knowledge into yourself.
Yeah, you're right about that. All great books. I've read them all. I would also recommend them. There's some kick-ass recommendations, Don. I appreciate that. If you could go back to 2003, you're just getting in the business, and you could share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself, what would that be?
Get out of your own way, you know, don't let fear hold you back. Get out there and just do it. You know, don't be afraid to fail and make mistakes. My core belief in my organization, you know, the way I run the culture of my organization is it's okay to make a mistake. You know, if my team makes a mistake, we just figure out what the mistake was and we correct it. And so I would say, you know, get out there and fail, make mistakes, learn from them, grow from them. You're going to become stronger. I failed miserably. I lost everything. I went so broke that I could hardly even keep the lights on for my family. I still lived through it. I'm a better husband, father, and business person because of it. So if I had let fear own me, I wouldn't be where I'm at right now. So just get out there and do it. You're going to learn it. Don't be scared to learn it.
Nice. Don, if anyone listening wants to get some more information about you, do you have a website or contact information you'd like to share?
Yeah, you know, I host the Flip Talk podcast. We have a website, fliptalk.com, and you can email me at don@fliptalk.com. I do respond to those emails. I'm on Facebook, you know, constantly. We have a Flip Talk podcast group where we answer a lot of questions, stuff like that, too, on Facebook. So, you know, I enjoy interacting with people. I enjoy providing content. I enjoy changing business and changing lives. I get a kick out of it. So, you know, reach out to me, say hello, ask any questions. And, you know, sometimes I'm slow to respond, but I always respond.
Cool. Don, I really appreciate you giving your time and sharing so honestly your insights and your business strategies and things you found out. So thank you for coming on the REI Diamond Show. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, my loyal listener, for checking out this episode of the REI Diamond Show. If you are interested in checking out the next episode pre-release before the email goes out, please subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you'd like a PDF download of my book on wholesaling, all 164 pages of Become a Wholesale Real Estate Master, go to reidiamonds.com and enter your email address. After you confirm that email address, you will receive a second email containing a download link for near instant access to that book, which is pretty much the business plan I used to build Diamond Equity Investments. If you have investment capital on the sidelines, not already earning above average returns, you should go check out superchargedreturns.com. When you enter your email address there, I'll send you an email with the next upcoming private mortgage investment opportunity that I have available in either Chicago, Atlanta, Florida, or Philadelphia. Those private mortgages are then used to fund my fix and flip projects, as well as some short-term 90 days or less wholesale deals. Again, that site is superchargedreturns.com. And finally, if you have certain questions or topics you would like to see discussed on a future episode, or if you have a guest suggestion, somebody that you would like me to invite on the show, contact me directly by clicking on the Contact Dan link at reidiamonds.com. I personally monitor that contact form. And you can also check out any of the profitable real estate deals we have available in our various markets at that site as well. Thank you once again for being a loyal listener of the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.